Welcome to the New World. Episode 10, Aztec Collapse. For the last few episodes, I've been building a mental image in our brains of the Aztec Empire. Now we get to see this collide with the Spanish Empire, which was traveling inexorably and by design towards the wealthiest places in the Americas. So, here is the extra-long episode about the Aztec-Spanish War. The first contact between the Europeans and the Mexica isn't exactly clear. Columbus's fourth voyage had contacted their neighbors, the Mayans, over a decade ago, but their knowledge of the entire area of Mesoamerica was quite limited. The first trips of the Spanish to Mexico wasn't until 1518, when Juan de Grijalva explored the east coast on a slave trading expedition. Around this time, messengers bearing word of boats the size of mountains along the coast reached Emperor Moctezuma, who asked his advisor to find out more, if possible. Though he'd originally set out to make more substantial contact with the Mayans, who I swear I'll talk about eventually, Grijalva discovered that there was more to this area than just the Yucatan Peninsula. In fact, he was told of a great empire lying to the west, led by one Moctezuma. Moreover, he discovered that the people and goods who could be found here were of a much higher craftsmanship and quality than the Spanish had any previous experience with the Tainos and the Caribbean. This meant that upon his return to his uncle, Governor Velazquez of Cuba, Captain Grijalva had more or less planted a big sign on the shores of Mexico saying, "Free real estate," and any interested conquistador needed only a ship and some of his men to stake his claim. After all, it had already worked for Velazquez in Cuba, and Ponce de Leon in Puerto Rico, and Esquivel in Jamaica, and Balboa in Panama. They'd all used military force to carve out their own little fiefdoms, and were getting quite rich and powerful in the process. The man, not only to be next in this line of conquistadors, but to surpass all of them, was Hernando Cortes, or Hernan for short. He was a distant and illegitimate relative of that old guy Ovando, former governor of Santo Domingo. Born in the 1480s in the Castilian province of Extremadura, Cortes had arrived in the New World in 1506 to serve as a notary for his kinsman and the new governor. However, not long afterwards, he'd impressed Diego Velazquez enough that when the nobleman departed to conquer Cuba, he took Cortes with him as his personal secretary. Cortes continued to serve under Velazquez until he got word of Grijalva's discoveries just to the west. He was a smart guy who knew an opportunity when he saw one. So, he gathered 26 ships and 600 men. Among them were horses, guns, both big and small, 2 priests, and 20 women, who were either nurses, mistresses, or both. These people were not necessarily knights imbued with noble purpose. They were men who, in return for their service, expected Cortes to provide them with material wealth for themselves, whether that be in gold, land, slaves, or more. This was simply part of being a soldier, doubly so for a conquistador in this land of opportunity. As one conquistador on Cortes' expedition, Bernal Diaz de Castillo, said, he joined to, quote, "serve God and His Majesty, to give light to those who were in darkness, and to grow rich, as all men desire to do." Regardless of intention, Cortes had orders. Velazquez wanted him to settle Grijalva's newly discovered land in the name of Spain and her king, and to set about converting the people therein. Seemed simple enough. They set out for the Yucatan later that year being 1519. Upon their arrival a few days later, Cortes and his men were met by a friendly face, a Spanish face. It was Jerónimo de Aguilar, who had been shipwrecked on the Yucatan since 1509. In that time, he had lived among the local Mayans and had learned to speak their Yucatec language. Just as a side note, he also had a friend, Gonzalo Guerrero, who actually rose through the ranks of Mayan society, and by that point was a nobleman with several Mayan children. Guerrero would later die in battle, leading Mayans in combat against the Spanish. Cortes, meanwhile, needed someone who spoke the local language, so he ransomed Aguilar to serve in his retinue as an interpreter. Continuing to the south, Cortes attacked the Mayan city of Potonchan, and as a peace offering, they presented his men with 20 slave girls. Upon the arrival of these women, one of Cortez's priests sprinkled them with holy water and rechristened them with Spanish names. They were then presented to the men as concubines, to put it mildly. Cortez, in particular, was known for being a womanizer, and I'm sure you can guess that not all of his partners were willing ones. The Mayans, hoping to get rid of these bearded strangers, also directed them westward. If these Spanish wanted gold, there was no better place to get it than in the empire of Moctezuma. Spoils in hand, Cortez and company set off by sea, landing at the site of a new city they would soon name the Rich City of the True Cross, though we only say the True Cross bit, which in Spanish is Veracruz. After a few brief moments, though, they were approached by natives in canoes, and it became immediately clear that Aguilar was already useless. The messengers who approached did not speak Mayan. They spoke some language he had never heard before. Cortez, frustrated that this Spaniard he had ransomed did not speak the language of the Indians, was at a loss on how to proceed. Just then, one of the Mayan slave girls, who the Spaniards had named Marina, stepped forward. It turned out that she was originally from the town of Coatzacoalcos, a Nahuatl city which had been attacked by the Mexica when she was a child. Not wanting to be the concubine of one of Cortez's particularly cruel officers, she made herself indispensable to the entire expedition by speaking to the messengers in Nahuatl, then in Yucatec Mayan to Aguilar, who then spoke in Spanish to Cortez. Through this telephone game, Cortez learned he was speaking to none other than messengers of Moctezuma II. The emperor had ordered that this area be watched ever since the Spanish were first sighted passing by here a year ago. That was Grijalva's expedition, by the way. Cortez asked that he be able to meet Moctezuma personally, and the messengers replied, "We'll think about it." After getting a good idea of the Spanish expedition's size and weaponry, the Aztecs headed back to Tenochtitlan. Now it's time to talk about the first major myth of this part of the story, that Cortez was believed to be a god. In his book and writing from Spanish sources, Hugh Thomas claims that Cortez landed in an area thought to be the prophesied return spot of Quetzalcoatl, the god who is related to the wind, merchants, and learning. Cortez supposedly played up these thoughts to make himself and his men untouchable in the eyes of the locals, so that they could more easily win the hearts and minds of the Aztecs. On the other hand, Camilla Townsend, writing from an Aztec perspective, claims that this god narrative was only invented decades after the fact and never spoken of by Cortez himself. I'm more inclined to believe the latter suggestion. The Spanish would have taken any opportunity to make themselves look as good as possible in the eyes of the natives, but the Mexica were an intelligent people. They more than likely saw the Spanish as men. Strange, bearded men who wore armor and weapons they'd never seen before, but men nonetheless. After all, would gods need to build huge campfires and cover themselves in mud and grease just to keep the mosquitoes away? In any case, Moctezuma was now aware of the fact that hundreds of strange, armed men had come ashore on his territory. He convened a council of nobles to discuss what to do next. Down on the shore, Marina, also known respectfully as Doña Marina by her new conquistador friends, was having a much better time. She was getting a hang of Spanish and was no longer a sex slave of Cortez's underlings. The locals could not make an R sound, so they referred to her as Malina, or more often as Malintzin, the suffix being an honorific. The Spanish, who could not make the Z sound, called her Malinche. Thus, we have a name that most scholars will call this woman, who is incredibly key to the events of the Aztec-Spanish conflict. Many historians have argued about Malinche's intentions and whether or not she acts like some kind of traitor to her people. I'm more in line of thinking that she's not. Her people, after all, were attacked and killed by the Mexica, who sold her into slavery to the Mayans. I think Malinche was just trying to make the best out of a bad situation that she was placed in. She might not have even volunteered to be a translator in the first place, instead forced to against her will. Either way, she now found herself possibly the most important member of the Spanish force, second to Cortez himself. Messengers soon arrived from Moctezuma. They would not escort Cortes to Tenochtitlan, but they bore gifts meant to either keep the Spanish friendly at Veracruz, or to maybe even bribe them into leaving. Either way, Moctezuma was not initially hostile to them. It turns out, though, paying someone to not attack you often just makes them think you've got even more money tucked away somewhere. Cortes was convinced that he needed the wealth of the Aztecs, but his men were far too few to go up against the many armies of Moctezuma, no matter how well armed they were. He needed friends, and luckily there were many friends to be found, namely those in the four cities of Tlaxcala, further inland. Just before taking off, though, a messenger arrived from Governor Velazquez. The governor had suspected that Cortes was getting a little too big for his britches, so to speak, and was no longer convinced that Cortes would want to remain under his jurisdiction if he conquered the Aztecs all by himself. Velazquez decided to revoke his former lieutenant's command. It was here, with this news, that Hernando Cortes decided to go all in on this gamble. He bribed the Cuban messenger by promising to give him a bigger share of the spoils. He also sent some men directly to Spain to plead his case with King Charles's court and the other Castilian nobility. Then, he either beached or destroyed all of his remaining ships. There was no going back now. The Spanish followed their local guides from the hot and humid beaches up to the cool pine forests in the lands of the Tlaxcala. Here they found that these people were not as friendly as they might expect, and promptly engaged the Spanish force in combat not long after they crossed the border. After all, having hundreds of armed strangers show up at your border doesn't exactly seem like a good sign. Within a few short skirmishes, though, the Tlaxcalans realized that not only that the Spanish were powerful fighters, but that they both had a vested interest in seeing the wealth of the Aztec capital redistributed, so to speak. The Spanish were brought peacefully into Tlaxcalan territory, and Malinche helped to craft a deal. With a marriage between Aguilar and some other officers, and the daughters of Tlaxcalan nobles, the alliance was sealed. Cortes left Tlaxcalan territory with thousands of more soldiers, and they headed directly for Tenochtitlan. In the capital, Moctezuma began to grow concerned. If the Spanish and the Tlaxcala fought and won even a single battle so close to Tenochtitlan, it would no doubt convince others that this whole Aztec Empire thing was a bit of a fad, and that they should hitch their proverbial horse to Cortes's wagon. The Aztec power base was built on intimidation and the knowledge that no one city-state could stand up to their power. If this illusion of hegemony was shattered, he'd be in big trouble. So he did what he thought he had to do. He offered the Spanish more stuff if they would please, please go away. If the Spanish wanted the riches of the Aztec Empire, he would give them what they wanted, for now, so long as they kept their new army away from his lands. This offer only further emboldened Cortes and the Tlaxcalans, who kept marching west. In the city of Cholula, Cortes and his group discovered a potential plot by the citizens to attack them on Moctezuma's behalf. So, they burned the city to the ground, including the temple of their patron god, Quetzalcoatl. By November 1519, the Spanish and Tlaxcalans had reached the shores of Lake Texcoco. Even in the suburbs and outskirts of Tenochtitlan, the Spanish found themselves in utter awe of the place. One of the men on the expedition, Bernal Diaz de Castillo, famously wrote from the city of Iztapalapan that, quote, "These great towns and pyramids and buildings rising from the water, all made of stone, seemed like an enchanted vision from the tale of Amadis. Indeed, some of our soldiers asked if it were not all a dream." Of their present location, he stated this, quote, "Large canoes could come into the garden pond from the lake through a channel they had cut. Everything was shining with lime and decorated with all kinds of stonework and paintings which were a marvel to gaze on. I stood looking at it and thought that no land like it would ever be discovered in the whole world." On November 8th, the Spanish and Tlaxcalans, led right up front by Cortes and Malinche, crossed the southern causeway and made it to the edge of Tenochtitlan. Here to greet them was not an army, but instead hundreds of noblemen from across the empire. After over an hour of watching these nobles come before him and performing a ceremony of touching the earth, Cortes was led down the straight, clean streets of Tenochtitlan and into the central plaza. Here, at last, they were finally received by the emperor himself. I read two interesting accounts of this meeting. In a more Eurocentric version, the opulent Montezuma, descended from a litter complete with tons of jewels and rare feathers. In the more Aztec-centric version, Cortes rudely attempts to greet the emperor with a big bear hug before being stopped by his bodyguards. Regardless, what followed was an exchange of necklaces, with Cortes presenting one of pearls and glass, and Moctezuma one of red snail shells and shrimp made of gold. Moctezuma then invited them into his city as honored guests. Another common conception of this time portrays Moctezuma as a weak-willed or indecisive ruler who brought about the destruction of his own people through placating and appeasing the people who had no intention of leaving. Of course, we know that Moctezuma, if he ever was this way, wasn't in his earlier days. Through our history of the pre-Cortez Aztecs, we've seen that Moctezuma has done much to centralize and empower his own position as the head of the empire. But despite this, he was still just dependent on his suzerainty over the subject cities. Many places were still led by their Tlatoani, just as they always had been, with their own laws and only a little Aztec oversight. Most of their interaction with Tenochtitlan was a scheduled delivery of their goods to the capital as tribute. If they saw which way the wind was blowing, they could join with the Spanish in hopes of freeing themselves from the Aztecs entirely, like the Tlaxcalans did. Now, especially with so many of their representatives here in the city, all Moctezuma could hope to do was keep the Spanish happy until they either left or made themselves so unlikable that all of Mexico would turn against them. So, it continued. The Spanish toured the city, taking any gold they could find, even though the Aztecs repeatedly asked them to just name their price and leave. Moctezuma sent three of his daughters to be married to the Spanish, who baptized them and gave them Christian names, before likely treating them much as the same as Malinche had once been treated. It turned out that Moctezuma's gamble was beginning to pay off, and the people of the city were quickly beginning to become quite unfriendly to their guests. Soon, only a catalyst was needed to light this powder keg. That catalyst turned out to be several ships arriving on the coast. As it happened, Governor Velazquez had decided to send conquistadors under his second-in-command, Narvaez, not to help Cortes, but to bring him in. With the news that Cortes wasn't exactly acting with the full backing of his own people, Moctezuma would surely look to assist Narvaez, and in so doing, get a more friendly relationship with the Spanish ruler, whoever he was. As soon as he got word of this, Cortes made another big choice. He had his men seize Moctezuma and imprison him in his palace. If the emperor ordered his people to rise up in revolt or something like that, he'd be killed. With his imperial hostage in place, Cortes set off with most of his men and went down the coast. One source I read stated that this was in April of 1520, while another source said this happened only a few days after the Spanish arrived, in November the previous year. That would mean the Aztecs knew their emperor was captive for over 7 months and did nothing, maybe in fear that he would be hurt? My Eurocentric source claims that during this time, Moctezuma and Cortes not only became friends, but Moctezuma proclaimed himself a vassal of King Charles, and Cortes even claimed that the emperor wanted the Spaniard to take care of his daughters, should he be killed. This seems a little hard for me to believe, but the main thing we should take from all this is that Cortes did imprison Moctezuma for some amount of time, and the Aztecs were not happy about it. Cortes caught Narvaez by surprise in an ambush, and captured Narvaez. As it turned out, most of the newly arrived conquistadors didn't need too much convincing to get in on the action and get all the wealth they could find out of this unspoiled land. Instantly, Cortes had more than doubled his Spanish manpower. Honestly, though, imprisoning an emperor in his palace while 400,000 of his very angry people surround you isn't the best idea under any circumstances. Add to the fact that Cortes left the city with a good portion of his men, and you have a guarantee that things won't end well. One of Cortes's paranoid lieutenants made the very smart decision of cornering a bunch of potentially unruly Aztec citizens at a religious ceremony and murdered them in droves. The people of the city naturally responded by taking up arms and chasing the Spanish and the Tlaxcalans to the palace of Axayacatl, where they immediately became besieged. Upon hearing of this, Cortes and his new army made straight for the city. They actually were allowed all the way into the palace unharmed. But, as it turns out, this was just a part of the Mexica's plan. With all of their rotten eggs in one basket, the angered people of the city destroyed all of the causeways leading out of town and made their assault. While the Aztec people crashed upon the barricades of the invaders, the prisoner Moctezuma stepped out to speak to his people. He made an impassioned plea to the citizens, begging them to stop the violence. My guess is he was forced to do so by Cortes in some last-ditch effort to have them stand down. Here, Moctezuma met his end, either from a stab in the back by his Spanish captors once they realized it wasn't working, or by a rock thrown from his people who felt very betrayed. With their leader dead, the Mexica needed a new ruler. That man happened to be Cuitlahuac, the younger brother of Moctezuma, who wasn't nearly as concerned with peace on earth as his brother was. He informed Cortes that he was willing to kill all the Spaniards and Tlaxcalans, no matter how many of his own people had to die in the process. Upon hearing this news, Cortes decided it was time to leave. Gathering their gold and putting Malinche under heavy guard, the Spanish and Tlaxcalans broke out of the palace on the 30th of June and made a mad dash for the exit. All the causeways were out, save for one that was just partially destroyed. Their only hope was a portable bridge they'd built from wood in the palace. Although it was nighttime, it took only a few seconds before the sentries alerted the entire city to their presence. People poured out of their houses, attacking and killing every last Spaniard of Tlaxcalan who couldn't run away fast enough. They shot arrows from rooftops, or threw darts from canoes, or stabbed at horses from spears. Men were forced into alleyways where they could be butchered more easily. It was an absolute massacre. The makeshift bridge that the Spanish brought only got a few people across. The rest drowned in massive numbers, until their own bodies served as a bridge of its own for others to climb over. By the time the night was over, and the survivors had fled to Tlaxcala, more than two-thirds of the Spanish force was dead, including most of their horses and whatever gold they'd been carrying. Even Cortes, who had to have two fingers amputated after the flight, speculated that 2,000 of his men had been lost. Who knows how many Tlaxcalans died in the escape as well. The Night of Sorrows, or La Noche Triste as it became known, had been an incredible Aztec victory, and the enemies of the Empire hid away in Tlaxcala. Theoretically, if the Aztecs thought the Spanish might come back, now was the time for Cuitlahuac to go on the offensive. His enemies were fewer in number than they'd ever been, they'd been cast out of the city, and Cortes was a long way from any potential reinforcements. After all, Governor Velazquez in Cuba wasn't going to send anyone else. But, unknown to the new Emperor Cuitlahuac and his people, the Spanish had a weapon far greater than any steel sword or gunpowder arquebus, one they didn't even know they had. By the time Cortes and his men had turned tail and fled Tenochtitlan, that weapon had already started to make itself known in the crowded Calpoli of the city. It's suspected that one of Narvaez's men had been sick by the time they'd reached the shores of Mexico in April of 1520. Whether he knew it or not, that sickness, smallpox as it turned out to be, was carried from the conquistador to the people of the strange land he had come to fight in. It began to spread through many of the city-states of Mexico. The people of the Americas had absolutely no experience with smallpox, but even the Europeans knew just how deadly of a disease it could be. smallpox is transmitted through a number of ways, through the air, bodily fluids, or even contaminated objects. Within a few days, the infected person has a fever, muscle pain, fatigue, vomiting, and a headache. Leaking pustules appear all over the body. The victim dies a painful death. But the disease doesn't just cause death, it also causes chaos. As anyone who survived 2020 knows, human beings don't handle pandemics very well, under the best of circumstances. Trade shuts down, people quarantine entire areas, others flee as far as they can, inadvertently taking the plague with them. For the Spanish, this was nothing new. Many of them were immune, having been infected as children, and survived. Unfortunately, the highly urbanized and interconnected people of Mexico were incredibly easy targets for smallpox, none of them more so than the great metropolis of Tenochtitlan, which received visitors and goods from across the entire region. It's difficult for me to overstate how incredibly serious and devastating this epidemic was. It utterly laid waste to the Aztec capital, killing a third of all its residents in a few short weeks. Consider the fact that 400,000 people lived in the city, and you can see how devastating a plague of that size would be. It was a shockingly huge loss in a shockingly short amount of time. Everyone lost someone. Among the dead, after only 80 days of rule, was Emperor Cuitlahuac himself. This very same smallpox epidemic would go on to spread across not only Mexico, but much of North and South America, claiming the lives of people thousands of miles away who had never even heard of the Aztecs, but still died from a disease brought to them from Europe. While the Aztecs were dying off in droves and growing weaker by the day, the Spanish were quickly recuperating. Like most other city-states in Mexico by now, Tlaxcala was also suffering from the smallpox epidemic, and their leaders were still debating whether or not to get rid of the Spaniards before it was too late. However, they reasoned that only more would come from across the water, and sure enough, they were right. Cortes sent men to the coast to repair one of his beached ships and buy more supplies in the Caribbean if he could. However, they instead found seven more Spanish ships and hundreds more men disembarking on the beaches. It turned out that Cortes's politicking and begging in the court of King Charles had paid off. Plenty of Europeans had heard all about the potential wealth and success to be found in the New World, and eagerly headed across the Atlantic to join Hernando Cortes and his men. This new wave of reinforcements helped convince many more of the Aztec Empire's vassal states to join in with Cortes. One of these was a founder city of the Triple Alliance, Texcoco, whose ruler had been put in by Moctezuma and overthrown by his own brother, who gladly joined Cortes against further Aztec dominance. Where diplomacy failed, Cortes used force and conquered several cities of his own to incorporate them into his growing army. By early 1521, the Spanish had far more men on their side than ever before. Charles Mann claims that this force even numbered in the hundreds of thousands, like 200,000 men. Now with sufficient strength, Cortes set out for Tenochtitlan once again. This time, though, he set out by water. On the shores of Lake Texcoco, his men had constructed brigantines, small sailboats which had little problem navigating the shallow waters. The Tenochtitlan they finally reached was quite different from the one they had fled. The once vibrant city was plague-stricken and starving. Tributes of food had long since stopped, either having been seized by the Spanish, or simply not paid by their rebellious Tlatoani. The new emperor, a descendant of the great Itzcoatl, named Cuauhtémoc, could barely keep a hold of his seat on the reed mat and had to maintain his authority. He had to kill two of Moctezuma's seditious sons to do so. He'd also only barely convinced a few cities to come to his defense, and was barely subsisting off the chinampas and fish from the lake. Just 2 years ago, his predecessors controlled the entire country from sea to shining sea. Now, Tenochtitlan was reduced back to its roots, a lowly city-state, depending on its position on the lake for its survival. It was from the lake that Cortes came. The battle for Tenochtitlan that resulted was more like a siege. Though the Mexica were battered, underfed, plague-stricken, and withering, they refused to give up their city without a fight. Over the course of the next 3 months, they fought the Tlaxcalans, Texcocans, and their Spanish leaders, tooth and nail, in every neighborhood, house by house. The Spanish secured the city neighborhood by neighborhood, knocking down buildings and barricades alike to create more open spaces for their horsemen and gunners. Though the Mexica fought hard, even capturing many European weapons for themselves, they could only do so much now that enemy boats surrounded their island city and their backs were quite literally to the wall. They demolished bridges behind them and attempted to make shows of force of their own, like eating in full view of the enemy, to demonstrate that they still had plenty of food, even though most of them were starving. But by this point, they'd been driven into only one corner of the city, with no allies and nowhere else to go, and they were utterly exhausted. On August 13th, 1521, Cuauhtémoc, the Huey Tlatoani of the Triple Alliance, paddled out in a canoe with his wife and a few Pipiltin advisors. He surrendered himself and his city to Hernando Cortés. Thus ends the Aztec-Spanish War, and with it, the Aztec Empire as a whole. After 2 centuries of expansion and development into one of the greatest powers in Mesoamerican history, the Mexica were torn down in just 2 catastrophic years by their own subjects, led by strangers. You can blame it on any number of things, from the inaction of Moctezuma II, to the deadly epidemic of smallpox, to the simple superiority of Cortés and his men. Out of anything, though, what comes to mind for me was that the Aztecs were a glass cannon. Moctezuma didn't act when the Spanish and Tlaxcalans arrived in central Mexico, because he was afraid of losing the reputation of superiority he had among the other city-states, a fear that was realized when Cortés began to turn his vassals in droves after La Noche Triste. Plenty of cities had grievances with the government in Tenochtitlan, even among the founding members of the Triple Alliance. After all, the Tlaxcalans didn't join up with the Spanish because they had any affinity for Spain. They'd only even known about the existence of these people for weeks, and they had no religious, cultural, or linguistic ties. The only thing that brought them together was that the Spanish and Tlaxcalans both desired to march on Tenochtitlan and reap the rewards afterward. The same can probably be said for many other Mexican city-states. If they weren't going to actively take part in destroying the Aztecs, then they'd at least deny them the help they needed to survive. As for the Aztecs, I'd imagine the epidemic was the most damaging. Having a plague kill a third of your population in your capital is no small matter, especially since Tenochtitlan was the endpoint of a tribute delivery system that made the city so wealthy. By the time the Aztecs had Cuitlahuac, a ruler who wanted to attack the Spanish no matter the cost, they were already being significantly weakened from the inside. Some people might put the blame on Cortés' excellent leadership, but any supposed genius on Cortés' part seems to be on a more small-scale tactical level rather than on a strategic one. After all, La Noche Triste seemed to have resulted from his foolish desire to keep Moctezuma captive in his own palace, surrounded by hundreds of thousands of hostile citizens. It was only through luck and good timing that he received reinforcements from those Spanish adventurers, or from Narváez's Cuban force that easily could have ousted him, as it was meant to. The conquistadors were always small in number, around 1 or 2,000, so the support of the many tens of thousands of allied warriors seems to be what carried them through battles like the Siege of Tenochtitlan at the end of the war. That's just my opinion, though. Regardless of what you might want to blame on the events of these past 2 years, the simple fact of the matter is that the world is now changed. An empire has been toppled, and the Spanish will rush in to take its place. Cortés will become the quintessential conquistador, a man who arrived on the shores of a completely alien empire and conquered it by the time he was in his late 30s. He will be the de facto lord of a region full of people who did not speak Spanish, and were totally unfamiliar with the concept of Jesus Christ. The Aztec Empire may be gone, but it is certainly not forgotten. Tenochtitlan will still exist as the center of power in the region, though it will be renamed to La Ciudad de México. And the memory of the Mesoamerican Empire will remain in the minds of Americans everywhere. If you want proof of this, just look at the Mexican flag. Atop the green, white, and red tricolor sits the eagle on its cactus, eating the snake. A sign from Huitzilopochtli that this was the new home of the Mexica. Yes, the Aztecs are defeated, but they aren't going anywhere anytime soon.